Good evening, everyone. Broadcasting live. December 11th, 2015. Tonight we have a Dhammapada story, so we're broadcasting only audio for the first bit. Let's make sure that we're actually broadcasting. Test. Yes, I believe we are. Okay, so we're ready to go. Test. Hello and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Today we continue on with verses 119 and 120, which read as follows. Papo pipassati bhadrang yava papang na pachati yadacha pachati papang atta papo papani pasati. Bhadropi pasati papang yava bhadrang na pachati yadacha pachati bhadrang atha bhadro bhadrani pasati. Just a little bit of a tongue twister because of the alliteration, which is purposeful. It's a play on the Pali, so if you read it you can see the words that are very similar. But it means, even an evildoer will see benefit or good things. Yava papang na pachati. For as long as the evil doesn't ripen. Yadacha pachati papang atta papo papani pasati. But when the papa, the evil ripens, then the evildoer will see evil. That's verse 19. Verse 20 is the opposite. Even a good doer sees evil, for as long as may see evil. No? For as long as the good doesn't bear fruit or doesn't come to fruition. Doesn't ripen. But when the goodness ripens, then the good doer sees goodness. This verse was taught in regards to a story of Anattapindika, the Buddha, one of the Buddha's chief lay disciples, lay supporters. So here was a man who, the word Anattapindika, anatta, natta means a refuge, anatta means one who has no refuge. It's a word that was used to refer to poor people, the helpless. And pindika, well, pinda means a ball of rice, or it means rice. And pinda and ika, or nika, means one who has. So this means one who has alms or a ball of rice for the helpless. So he's the giver of alms. That's his name. That's the name he was given. And for with good reason, because not only did he support the Buddhist monks, but he was kind and generous, and he would give alms to poor people, I guess, as well. And he was also quite generous. So it seems that not only did he give great gifts to by actually buying this forest of Jeta's, of Prince Jeta, and giving it to the Buddha and as a monastery, but he also was generous with his friends and associates, it seems. So over time, even though he was quite rich, over time he lent out a lot of his money, huge amounts of it, really, and people wouldn't pay him back. And at the same time, he had, in those days, they didn't have banks, so they would hide their, they would bury their valuable. And they had buried it in the ground near a river, and the river had overflown, and the bank had eroded, and all of a great deal of his wealth, his family's wealth was swept out to sea. And so Anathapindika, whenever he went to the monastery to see the Buddha, he would never go empty-handed. He would always, in the morning, he would bring food. In the afternoon, he would bring juice, and he would always bring with him gifts, sort of, they have religious gifts of incense and candles and maybe not candle, incense and flowers, garlands of flowers, that kind of thing. But even though he was starting to become actually quite impoverished, so he had lost really the bulk of his wealth, he never stopped giving. Even if it was just a little, he never gave it up. And so the Buddha asked him one day, "Are you still giving alms at your house?" And he said, "Yes, Venerable Sir, I'm still giving alms, but it's not as refined as it once was, or not as high quality as it once was." And the Buddha gives a quote which is actually quite I think it's natti citte prasannam hi. Yeah, here we are. Cittasmin hi panitte. It's a different quote, sorry. Cittasmin hi panite Buddha dinang dinadanang dukkhang namanati. It's a paraphrase of a different quote, which I actually think, I can't remember whether it was the Buddha who actually said it, but it's a very common quote. Nati citte prasannam hi apakanamatakina. There's no such thing as a gift, as a small gift. When it's given in faith and given just to one who deserves it. So here he says, almost the same with Lukang Nama Nati. There's no such thing as a coarse gift. When the gift is given out of with a pure heart, with a bright heart, and given to a suitable recipient. And he went on and reassured Anathapindika and said, "You know," and he told a story of his past life, I think, about how he once tried to, was very kind to people and still wasn't able to move them, but he never wavered in it. So anyway, he reassured or gave reassurance or encouragement to Anathapindika and appreciated the fact that he gave. It's actually a thing in Buddhism that giving be a part of our life. I mean, I've been talking quite a bit about giving. You can see how many of these are giving, but it does bear mentioning that even though our focus is meditation practice, that giving is, the Buddha said, if beings knew the benefit, the true benefit of giving, no one would eat a meal without giving a portion of it or some gift or some part of it to another person who was worthy of it. No, to some, if there was someone there worthy of it, and they wouldn't eat without sharing. No one would eat a single meal if they really knew, he said, the way I know. And he said, but it's because people don't know that they don't share and they don't think to give. There's much made in the suttas about the difference between the benefit that you get in eating food or partaking of your possessions, and the benefit that comes from giving and sharing your possessions with others. It's quite a different benefit and on a different scale. So this was, this was really par for the course, and Natapindika was doing something that, though hard to do, is a very typical Buddhist thing, is you give according to your means, but giving is a part of one's spiritual life, especially as a lay person. I mean, but even as monks, for monks, as I've talked about, how we share and give and actually have an easier time with it because we don't need as much. We don't have as many uncertainties in our lives, in the sense that if we don't have to worry about our car breaking down or someone breaking into our house, or we don't have to worry about what clothes we're going to wear to work and so on. We don't have as many requirements placed on us. So giving for monks is actually in many ways easier. But anyway, very much a part of our spiritual practice. So this is the setting, but the story, there was a goddess, or not goddess, you would say more like a female angel, living in Anattapindika's house. I guess in his mansion, he had a fairly large residence. And I guess at each of the four doors, the four gates to his residence, there was an angel. Anyway, at one of the gates, or maybe the gate, she was sort of like the spiritual guard over the gate. Had for a long time been concerned about Anattapindika's generosity, because as many earth angels would be, she was very enamored of the jewels and the valuables in his house. And so for a long time she'd wanted to kind of push him towards conserving his wealth, and not giving it away, because every time valuables left the house, that would be it. She'd never see them again, and it felt all she ever saw was this diminishing pile of wealth, and in later times, it diminished quite a bit. And so now it was mostly gone, and at this point she couldn't bear it anymore. And so she decided to herself that she would have to do something about this. And so in the middle of the night, she went to him. She had never felt confident, or she'd never dared to go to him before that, because he was rich and powerful and so on. But now he was a poor man, and so she felt comfortable going to him. She went in the middle of the night and stood by his bed, or floated in the air above his bed, and maybe glowing or so on. And Anattapindika opened his eyes and said, "Who is that?" And she said, "It is I, great Seti," which means not treasure, but just a rich person. "The goddess, I am the goddess that resides over your fourth gate. I am come to give you an admonition, come to give you a teaching, and to admonish you." And he said, "Well then, tell me, what do you have to say?" And here's her admonition: "Great treasurer, great wealthy man, without considering the future, you have dissipated your great wealth in the religion of the monk Gotama. Now, although you have reduced yourself to poverty, you still continue to give of your wealth. If you continue this course, in a few days you will not have enough left to provide you with clothing and food. Of what use to you is the monk Gotama? Abandon your lavish giving, devote your attention to business, and make a fortune." Sounds like solid advice, right? For those of us living in the world. Why would you waste your money on this bald-headed, shaved, this shaved recluse? In fact, we often criticize people who give to religious causes, and we criticize religious institutions as being money hungry because they usually just want money and they're collecting money all the time. I think Buddhism is very guilty of that. I mean, we are even, our organization even does that sort of thing. There's a lot of talk about money, which is, I guess, in a way unfortunate, but in another way, it's important to recognize that it's a part of spirituality to give of your resources, to share and to let go, to not cling, certainly not to worry about such things, but to use and to put to use your resources for the best of causes, the best benefit. And so Anathapindika says, "Is that the advice you came to give me?" "Yes, sir." He says, "Then be gone. Though 100,000 like you should try, you would not be able to move me from my course. You have said to me what you had no right to say. What business have you to dwell in my house? Leave my house instantly." He banished her from his house, and because he was such a powerful person and also a Sotapanna, she was unable to. Angels are somehow sensitive in this way. She was unable to stay there. She just couldn't stay in the house anymore. I mean, however, the other angels probably wouldn't have let her stay anyway. So she left. But after leaving, she couldn't find lodging anywhere else. I guess even angels have difficulty. Probably she was at that point ostracized by the other angels, other earth angels. And so she wandered trying to find a way, and she went finally to the city angel. There's an angel who looks after the city of Savatthi. And she explained her problem and said, "Please help me to take me to the, if you can come with me to the treasurer and speak on my behalf and get him to forgive me for saying that." But the angel of the city shook his head and said, "You said something that you had no business to say. Like, this is not possible for me. I can't help you. I'm sorry." So at her wit's end, she decided to go the next step up, which is the four great kings that you hear about in Chinese mythology. It comes from Buddhism. Buddhism talks about four gods that apparently look after the four directions. I don't know, or four gods, four angels that look after the, I don't know, four quarters of the earth maybe. Maybe the four different continents or something. And again, they said the same thing, that they couldn't help her. And so finally, she went up to the Dawadingsa heaven, where she really wasn't. See, she was very low on the angel hierarchy, so this is like going to see the king, like a peasant going to see the king. But she managed to get an audience with Sakka, the king of the angels of the Dawadingsa heavens. And she told the story and said, "I can't find it. I have nowhere to live, and I've done something really reprehensible, and now I wander about without protection." It says, ironically, or strangely, children in hand. I mean, angels don't have children, so it's strange. It must mean the other angels that are in her retinue, because they don't give birth, as far as I know. Of course, who knows? I don't really know much about angels. And so she said, "Please help me to regain my privilege as gatekeeper." And Sakka replied, "I can't. I'm sorry. I can't help you. It's not possible. Sorry, it's not possible for me to speak to the treasurer on your behalf. However, I will tell you a way." And she said, "Oh, please do. Tell me what it is." And here was Sakka, who was quite a wise man and also a Sotapanna. He said, "Go assume the dress of the treasurer's steward, or the rich man's steward, as he's like accountant, and take a piece of a leaf, you know, this is what they would write on, and list all the wealth he once possessed that he had lent out, and then go around to all the people who owe him money and convince them, use your angelic influence to get them to return to make good on their debts. And then go and find the huge amount of wealth that has been swept out into the ocean that used to belong to Anattapindika. And on top of that, find an equal amount that's scattered throughout or that has no owner, you know, wealth that is lost and has no owner, and bring that to him. Take all that wealth, deposit it in his safe house, and then go to him and ask forgiveness." And so she did this. And she went to the... And then she came to Anattapindika and said... knocked on his door, and he said, "Who is it?" Or she stood in the air radiating light. "Who is that?" And he said, "It is me. It is I, the blind, stupid goddess that once dwelt over your gate. Pardon me the words I once spoke to you in my blind stupidity. In obedience to the command of Sakka, king of the angels, I have recovered the wealth, your wealth, and filled your storeroom therewith. Thus have I atoned for my offense. I have no place wherein to lodge myself, and therefore am I greatly wearied." Anattapindika didn't accept her apology. He looked at her and thought, "Well, I know what I've got to do." And so he took her with him and brought her to see the Buddha. Because Anattapindika would have never been really likely upset with her and wouldn't have held a grudge. But his only concern really was for goodness and for righteousness. And so here, his only thought was to provide some goodness for this angel, to give this angel, make sure this angel got on the right track. It wasn't about apologizing to him. It was about having her understand goodness and evil, righteousness and unrighteousness. And so bringing her to see the Buddha was all about teaching her right from wrong. And so they came to the Buddha. And Anattapindika related the story to the Buddha, and then the Buddha taught them both, and in order to admonish them both, gave these two stanzas, or two verses. The first in regards to evil doers who still profit until their evil comes to fruition, and then the same goes with goodness. So you could say that the first one is a bit easier to see. We're more liable to see that one, I think, and to understand that one, that you can do evil deeds and still be protected from them, but there's no sense that you're not going to eventually be forced to pay the consequences. But with goodness, I think we have a little bit more trouble. I think for many people it's difficult to do good deeds, and when you undertake them, I mean, for people who aren't accustomed to doing good deeds, it's difficult to do them, and then when you've done them and don't get a result and feel like it's been for naught, you can be quite discouraged. But this is another one of those verses that puts that to rest and reminds us that that really is the case. Something that has a good result, even if good deeds do have a good result, you know, for many people this isn't a certainty, they're not sure whether it's right to do good deeds or whether good deeds can have a bad result and so on. But even when they do, even given that they do, it's not always evident right away. It's not always clear and apparent. This goes for charity, this goes for morality, this goes for meditation. sometimes meditation can appear to be fruitless. You practice, 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 and you still get angry, you still get greedy, you still have all these problems inside. It's in fact not even as clear as just taking time. It's also the mix of good and evil. You know, if you've done many things that are unwholesome, then they're going to play a part and they're going to mitigate the benefit of the good deeds. And the same goes with evil. When a person does evil, if they've also done many good deeds, which most human beings have in order to be born as human beings, they're going to be protected from their evil can be for quite some time, maybe even for their whole life, until they die and they're forced to feel the weight and the full force of the evil deeds, in which case it leads to unpleasantness in the future lives and so on. But a reminder for us, karma is not so simple as you do a good deed and then an angel shows up and gives you a reward. But these are the sorts of things that Anatta Pindika would have been aware of as a Sotapanna, because having practiced insight meditation, he was able to see cause and effect and understand where the true, what's really going on behind the scenes, because we obviously can't know what the cause of our deeds is going to be. You will do good deeds, you can't know what the fruit is going to be. How can you know then that evil is going to lead to evil? Because through meditation, you can see what's going on behind the scenes. You see the underlying framework, and you can watch as your mind changes and as the universe changes based on your deeds. If you do good deeds, how it changes for the better. If you do evil deeds, how it changes you, changes your attitude, and it has direct consequences on the world around you. You can see all of this moment to moment. And as you see this more and more and clearer and clearer, you have less and less doubt or concern about the results of your actions. What is it going to be? What's it going to bring? Because you know that you're planting seeds of happiness, seeds of greatness and goodness. You don't have to worry about what is the result, because you know it's going to be positive. That's the great, really the greatness of the law of karma, is the certainty of it. You don't have to be certain what's going to happen. You just have to be certain the nature of that what's going to happen. And it's never sure what exactly is going to come of your deeds. But it is sure the nature of the effect of certain deeds. Wholesome deeds have pleasant results, peaceful, happy, and good results. Unwholesome deeds have unpleasant, evil results. So it does have quite a bit to do with our meditation practice in terms of really understanding this, and in terms of being patient with our practice. Be patient with good deeds that you do for others. Don't concern yourself with what benefit, you know, I don't see any benefit from this. Never think like that, because you're very hard to see. Very hard to come back later and say, oh, that's because of that. There's so many different factors involved. Look more on the actual deed and the immediate results, what you're sending out into the universe, the energy that you're creating. So very, very important that when you do a good deed, you let it go. You do the good deed, and when they say don't think about the results, it's almost true. It's just not quite true, because you are very much focused on the immediate results. You're doing it because of the energy that it's putting out, positive energy. Don't concern yourself with actual results. And the same goes with meditation and things like morality and so on. Don't concern yourself, you know, why don't I feel better? Why do I still feel bad at times and so on? Why do I still have suffering? There's so many different factors involved. Some of them are even out of your control. You'll still feel physical pain, for example, and that kind of thing. But what we should look at is how the meditation is changing us at the moment that we perform it. Let that go, do it. and cultivate it and then let it go. And don't worry about how it's going to change your brain or your mind or your thoughts or the world around you. And you should never think like that. Never be concerned with the more abstract results. Except kind of in the back of your head or as a, oh gee, I'm a nicer person now, that kind of thing. But that should never be your focus. In meditation, the results should be the immediate results. What happens when you're mindful in that moment, and be content with that. That's how you know you're doing good. It's very important, because otherwise you're constantly judging and wondering, and everything is about expecting. I do a good deed because I expect some result. And you see how troublesome that is, how problematic that is, because it becomes no longer a good deed, it becomes more of a desire for good things to come to you, right? And meditation is the same. We don't meditate as a good deed anymore. Sometimes we meditate wanting good things to come to us, which can be an unwholesome thing. Instead, we should focus on the act and the moment, the benefit that comes from it. Because that will become real. That is real. That is here and that is now. So, anyway, that's the Dhammapada for tonight. Thank you all for tuning in. Wishing you all good practice and peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering. Thank you. Okay, and now we go live. We are live. Now we go video live. Hello everyone. Those of you on YouTube. We're broadcasting late because we've just done the Dhammapada. And I was going to turn all this off first, so excuse me. Many things to turn off. That's it. With me is Robin. Thank you for joining me, Robin, as usual.
Thank you, Bhante.
And I think we have some questions.
We do. This one goes back to last night, just before we signed off. It is easy to stay mindful during the gross sensations, but when subtle sensations come, desire to let them continue arises. How to understand dukkha in such situations?
Is that the suffering there is that they can't satisfy you? Suffering there is that they are not happiness. Truly, the suffering there is in the awareness of them as it's not a positive thing. It's a not happiness thing. So when you're mindful of them, you'll see instantly it's not an intellectual thing. You'll just feel the peace and you won't see it as happiness. You'll see the happiness and won't see it as happiness. I mean, as pleasant. You won't have any liking for it. Remember, the three characteristics are negatives. They're not positive qualities. Anicca means it's not permanent. Dukkha means it's not happiness. Or even if we want to go in more detail, it's you can't fix it. You can't. There's nothing to be. It's not a refuge. It's not a base. It's not something you can use to satisfy you, for example. But in general, it's not happiness, is the meaning. And anatta means it's not self. It's not controllable, it's not you, it's not yours. That kind of thing. So if you say to yourself, liking, liking, or feeling, feeling, or happy, happy, you'll see, you'll just let go of it immediately. Because once you see it clearly, you see there's really nothing inherently positive about it.
Bhante Sujato of the Ajahn Chah group once mentioned that the biggest eater in the world is time, but the Arahant eats time itself. In what sense does he eat it? Thank you, Bhante.
You have to ask Bhante Sujata, I don't know. I mean, Arahant has attained enlightenment, and Nibbana is out of time, is timeless, so that's probably what he's referring to.
If the Buddha was omniscient, why didn't he make scientific discoveries like discovering the law of electromagnetism to make technology and improve people's lives?
You really think electromagnetism has improved people's lives? I think there's a lot of it's funny, I mean it's not really a I'm not really impressed by the I sound so awful, no? It's not a great question. Sorry to say. Because why? There are so many things that you could say help people, right? I mean, even I think better than that example would be medicinal discoveries, right? Why didn't the Buddha tell us about penicillin, for example, right? Or give any number of things. And I mean, there's an argument to be made there, but even that is not a very, right, it's not a very deep question, or the answer is because those are not very deep, profound benefits. It doesn't really benefit people to have computers or. And so on. What benefits people is meditation, and so that's what the Buddha taught. It's a reasonable question. I shouldn't. I'm not really trying to discount it, but you have to understand. It's not really. I mean, it's on a whole other level. The Buddha's teaching is something quite different. It's like, why didn't the Buddha, if I were to ask you, why didn't the Buddha act as a doctor? Why didn't he cure people's sicknesses, right? Why didn't he help Anathapindika get his money back? Why didn't he go around telling the kings how to run? Why didn't he run for government? Why didn't the Buddha stay as a prince to rule his kingdom? And the answer is all the same. So, I mean, and the answer is, I think, fairly obvious. But I guess there's something a little bit more to your question. And it's more the simplicity of just telling people, right? But the answer is still stands, and it's that I suppose twofold. First of all, it's a waste of time that could be better used teaching. But it's also a distraction So not only did he have better things to teach, but if you start teaching people about technology, I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, suppose the Buddha had taught about electromagnetism. I mean, this is assuming he is omniscient, and I know there's a lot of criticism of that claim. So, I mean, I'm not in a place to say either way, but assuming he was omniscient, and it's not really omniscient either. You have to understand what omniscience means. Omniscience means, in Buddhism, it's not possible to be omniscient. But what is possible is that any question you put to your mind, the answer comes immediately. So, I mean, probably a simpler answer to your question would be, he would never have thought to ask the question. But not only would he have never thought to himself, hey, what is electromagnetism? He also wouldn't have had any interest in going there, because he had clear knowledge of what was of benefit. And so if he had gone out of his way to try to figure out, you know, how to make an iPad, imagine what that would have done, what a distraction that would have been. If he had explained about electromagnetism, or even penicillin, which would have saved people and helped people, the distraction that it would have provided. I'll give you an example. There's this monk who lives in California, who's spent a lot of his time giving people, providing people with cures to their sicknesses, and he apparently has some kind of magical power. I mean, this is all, he's very famous, and he was able to build a very beautiful monastery in California just because of his renown. And I've been critical of him because it's not really proper for monks to provide medical advice. We're actually forbidden to do it, and it's for this sort of reason. And also for the reason that then people expect it from monks, and other monks who are practicing and teaching meditation have difficulty, but mostly because it just distracts people away from meditation. And that's exactly what's happened. Apparently someone came to him and asked him, why don't you teach meditation? And he said, well, I would like to, but I have so many people coming to me now that, and everyone's just coming because they want their sicknesses cured, and they have, and people are always coming for medicine, and so he has no time to teach. And so even curing people's sicknesses would have a deleterious effect on one's ability to teach. It would make things worse, not better, ironically. So I guess it was an interesting question, some interesting discussion. I hope that helped to answer. Apologize. I don't mean, I often feel like I'm quite negative about these questions, and it's important to be sensitive to the fact that there are people out there who hear you say, that's a stupid question. Not really stupid. It's just, we have to be strict about this. We have to get to the truth of it. So I apologize if sometimes it sounds like I'm being hard on you.
Thank you, Bhante. Is it normal to separate your mind from your body when you meditate? I ask because today something very odd happened. I viewed myself after meditation as someone else. In other words, I existed in my mind, but I viewed my body as something completely different. I can only describe it like my body is a suit that I wear each day. For the record, I don't drink or take drugs, and as far as I know, I'm completely sane. It felt really peculiar. Is this normal?
Insane people think they're completely sane. Which is interesting, because I would say we're all a little bit insane. Just different degrees of insanity until you become an arahant, who would be completely sane. But that's, I think, neither here nor there. It is quite common relatively speaking, which, common would be there, if I had to guess, maybe 1 in 100 meditators. This is 1 in 100 people who do serious meditation, which I think is pretty common. It's probably even more common than that. But for the rest of you who are thinking, why doesn't that happen to me? Well, it's not that common. Depends on the individual. But I've heard many stories like this, and yeah, it happens. But my teacher once said it told a story about this monk who left his body, and he was wont to do this, so his students didn't know it, and one day they came in to see him and found that he wasn't responsive, and they called to him and he didn't move. And so he didn't extrapolate on it, but they gave him an injection. And I'm assuming it wouldn't have been an injection of formaldehyde, like they thought he was dead. But they gave him some kind of injection. And because of the injection, he couldn't come back. I think they must have felt the pulse, right? He wasn't dead, so there would have still been a pulse. But they thought he was in a coma or something, and so they brought the doctor, and the doctor gave him an injection. And because of whatever the injection was, he wasn't able to come back, and so he was trying to get back into his body, and he wasn't able to connect again, which was interesting. And so Ajahn said, it's better not to play with it, but if you have to, you need to put a sign up or something. I'm still alive, leave me alone. But he said, Ajahn said, when it happens, you should come. Just say, come back, coming back, and make yourself come back, kind of thing. And it's dangerous, he said.
It's probably a good lesson, too, if you come upon someone meditating, don't inject them with anything.
Yeah, he mentioned that. I mean, that happens in our tradition because we... there's the entering into cessation, and people can do that for hours as well. There's one nun who was very good at it, but to this day I don't think it really was what she thought it was, because she was one of the most foul-mouthed beings I've ever met. She would yell at people and scold them, and I saw her kill a mosquito once as well, so I don't think she was actually enlightened in any way. But she was able to enter into these trance states on will just in a few seconds. And she thought it was enlightenment. So, but they could, you could pick her up when she was in this state. You could pick her up and turn her around, and she would be stiff. And you could pick her up, and when she came back, she wouldn't have any recollection of it, I think.
And with that, we're all caught up on questions.
Okay. Good night. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Robin, for joining.
Thank you, Pompey.
Good night.
Good night.
Stop it, right?